guys. We're going to try to get started. I do like driving into the sunshine. I don't know about you guys. Sunshine makes a difference. All right. Well, we are in 2 Samuel chapter 11. And like I said last week, we're about to take a bit of a downturn in terms of successes for David. It's about to get rough for several chapters. And this chapter is, when you're studying it, as much as I've been going over this, the history here of David and all that, it's such a strange chapter. It comes out of nowhere, and you walk away from it going, what was David doing? Like, I don't know what happened. You know, and we can look at and see success and pride and that kind of stuff contributed, but this chapter is so out of character for him. And it's the one sin that's going to define him. I mean, in other places in Scripture, we've got those verses where it says, and David, you know, did all that the Lord commanded him, except for his sin with Bathsheba. I mean, this is going to stick with him. And I've got a slide later, but this is probably the second most notorious sin in the Bible after Adam and Eve. You know, it probably is in terms of ranking all that. So let me go through. And Chuck Swindoll says, our most difficult times are not when things are going hard. Hard times create dependent people. You don't get proud when you're dependent on God. Survival keeps you humble. Pride happens when everything is swinging in your direction, when you've just received that promotion, when you look back and you can see an almost spotless record in the last number of months or years, when you're growing in prestige and fame and significance. That's the time to watch out, especially if you're unaccountable. Our greatest battles don't usually come when we're working hard. They come when we have some leisure, when we've got time on our hands, when we're bored. And maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's that simple with David. Is he's unaccountable. He is the king of Israel. Right, he a united monarchy for the first time. You know, maybe that's what's contributing this, and he has free time on his hands, as we see at the beginning of this chapter. His army's out fighting battles, and he's back at home. And you know, I don't know about you guys, but it's for me, it's why I kind of like being busy. I kind of like having things to do, because if I have free time, I tend to not use that free time very wisely sometimes. I used to tell people when I played ball in college, I was a much better student in season than I was out of season. Because in season, I had to manage, all right, I got to be weightlifting here, I've got my workout here, I've got practice here, I've got games here, I've got to figure out when I'm going to get work done. But when I got the whole afternoon, it's like, well, I can take a nap, I can waste time here, I can, and nowadays, how many time wasters do we have at our disposal? You know, when it comes to social media and all that kind of stuff. So maybe it's that simple, that his pride had been fed. And so it sets up here in verse 1. Then it happened in the spring, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, but David stayed at Jerusalem. And I think that's the significant intro to this whole thing. And I think that's what the author's trying to tell us. Is David was not doing what he was supposed to be doing. And then we have to wonder why he's not doing what we're supposed to be doing. Now, these are the same Ammonites that he fought in the last chapter. That's the same city, Rabbah, that the Ammonites fled into when they were routed by Joab and the forces. And remember, Israel just went back home after that. And now they're going back, mainly because Ammon is in Israelite territory. They're in the regions of the Transjordan tribes, Gad and Manasseh. And to leave them there would be a danger for David, and so David has to go back in. It could be as much of a year has passed, we don't really know, but he sends them back in to kind of finish the job with these Ammonites who started something. Okay, so that's what I was just about to say. They need to send a military up there to defend it. So David stayed at Jerusalem, and this may have been a dereliction of duty, and like I said, I think that's the greatest possibility. That's how I interpret it, that David was supposed to be with his army. The king was supposed to go with his army. He's not. Later on in chapter 21, look at this verse. It says, then the men of David swore to him, saying, you shall not go out again with us to battle, so that you do not extinguish the lamp of Israel. So on top of just the success and the pride and the, you know, maybe lackadaisical attitude, he's got his men saying, you're the light of Israel. You're the lamp of Israel. We can't afford to lose you. Almost a little bit of an idol worship from his men, right? Stay back. We don't want you to die in battle. You know, and it's That's the difference from before, is David would go fight Goliath because he knew the Lord was with him. He would go fight these battles against Philistines and Amalekites and Ammonites because he knew the Lord was with him. Something in his mind has been shifted now. And he's listening to his men. He's listening to his pride. He's listening to all those things on the outside, and he doesn't go to war. He figures Joab can handle it, and he's too important. So again, this is probably the second most notorious sin in the Bible after the fall. It gets a lot of ink here. All right, 2-5. Now when evening came, David arose from his bed and walked around on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful in appearance. So David sent and inquired about the woman, and one said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" David sent messengers and took her, and when she came to him, he lay with her, and when she had purified herself from her uncleanness, she returned to her house. And the woman conceived, and she sent and told David and said, "I am pregnant." All right? Now, there is a lot of popular representations of this story. I would argue that a lot of them are a little bit inaccurate, okay? Because normally, where is Bathsheba bathing in most of the depictions that we find? Yeah, like up on a roof usually, right? She's bathing on the roof. And I'm going to tell you why I don't think that's exactly right. But first of all, notice the layout of the city of David, okay? And you can't really tell the geography in that drawing, but it's fairly steep, okay, from the top to the bottom. And David's palace is up here, okay? This is David's palace. He can literally stand, and you can, when you go to Israel today, you can stand up there at the top of the city of David, and you can look down, and it seems like it's a 45-degree angle. It's probably not, okay? But you're very steep. You can look down, and you can see the entire city from the top of it. All right, so in David's palace, as he walks out onto his balcony, he can literally see the entire city. I say that she doesn't necessarily have to be on the roof for him to see her. She doesn't have, now, let me tell you why I say that, because there are commentators that like to say, and I can't totally disprove this, but that Bathsheba was exhibiting herself for David. Okay. Now, that's not outside the realm of possibility, but we just read the text. Did you get any hint of that in the text? I mean, she's taking a bath. That's what people did. You know, there wasn't indoor plumbing. All right, you didn't get to go in the shower. This is how you took a bath. All right, so could she have been out there showing herself? Yes, she could have been, but the focus of this text is what David was doing. All right, that's what we know. We don't know what her sin was in all this. We know what David's sin was. And so there is a possibility, and I think that she was probably not necessarily always out there exhibiting herself. And I'll talk about how that goes through. It's a possibility, but we'll talk about it. So here's a typical, you know, Israelite dwelling in that time period. And so notice you have this upper platform up here. And really this upper room is kind of the main place you want to stay because you want breezes in the Middle East. It's warm, okay? So you want to have a place where you can go and catch the breezes in the evening, right? Now, they would also have kind of a little courtyard down here. I think this is much more likely the spot where Bathsheba was bathing. Okay, here's why. Is there running water in Israel? No. All right, so if you're going to have a bath and you don't have running water and you've got to bring that bucket over and dump it into the bathtub, are you going to take it all the way up to the roof and dump it in the bathtub and then go back down to your cistern or whatever and get more water and walk all the way back up to the roof and put more water in? It just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. I wouldn't be dragging water up three flights of stairs, not that there's three, but you know, I wouldn't be dragging water upstairs when I could do it right beside where the cistern would be. Right? So I think she's probably in her courtyard, and I think David is so high up in the city, he can look right down. Now, she may be fairly close to the castle, I don't know, or the palace, but he can look down and he can see her from his vantage point. So all that to say, there's no indication that that Bathsheba was out there putting out the vibe. Okay, that's not what we see in the text. Now, is it impossible? No. Maybe she was. Okay, maybe she was. But the focus of this story is David's sin. Right? It's kind of like when we go back to the garden. Whose sin is it in the garden? It's Adam's sin, right? And so that's what that's what Moses wanted us to get from Genesis 3, Genesis there, and this is what the author wants to get here. All right. So, all these Renaissance paintings, they always paint him quite literally. So we had to put a censored bar up there on Bathsheba. Okay, this is always how it's portrayed, right? That she was right outside his window on the roof. Now, that's not what the text says. That's all I want you to see. That's not what the text says. Okay? She could have been in close proximity. It's a small city, but I don't think it was quite that blatant. Okay, so again, no Israelite had running water at the time, so bathing most likely occurred in the enclosed courtyards that were prevalent at homes of the time. And again, the point being, there's no indication in the text that the woman deliberately positioned herself so as to entice David. Okay, all we get is that the woman was very beautiful. Now, that phrase is used in the Old Testament three times: Rebecca, Vashti, and Esther. Vashti and Esther in that same story there in the book of Esther, that these women were very beautiful. And you remember what happened with Vashti. That was rather disastrous as well. Okay, but David sends a messenger, and we discover that the woman is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. And the point of all that is she's not a nobody. Okay? Now, the other part, my wife and I were talking about this last night. Does David know who she is? Well, apparently not. At least at the distance he's at, he doesn't know who she is, because he says, go get it. Oh, that's Bathsheba. Oh, now once he hears the name, I guarantee you he knows who she is. Once he hears the name, I think he knows, because of the relations, and I'm going to show you that here. All right, she's the daughter of one of David's best fighters. Okay, in 2 Samuel 23:34, Eliam is listed as one of David's mighty men. So she's the daughter of one of his inner circle of soldiers. Okay, and then she's the granddaughter of his most trusted counselor, who's Ahitophel. And it says, the advice of Ahitophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one inquired of the Lord of God. So was all the advice of Ahitophel regarded by both David and Absalom. And this incident may be why Ahitophel goes with Absalom when the rebellion happens. Because David did this to his granddaughter, and he sides with Absalom in the rebellion. That seems like a natural reaction if I was the grandpa, right? And then most importantly, she's the wife of Uriah, who's one of his mighty men, again, one of his most honored soldiers. And so once David is properly informed of all this, he's already sinned, right? From Jesus' perspective, he has lusted in his heart. Clearly he's seen, he's lusted. Now, is he going to act on it? And the word he gets back is, she's the granddaughter of your most trusted advisor. She's the daughter of one of your great soldiers, and she's married to one of your other great soldiers. What do you want to do with that? And David says, bring her to me. Okay? So he has all the information he needs to say, not that it would make it any more right, but if she was a nobody, he could probably do this, and there's not a lot of social ripples in the pond, right? But this is a big deal. This, just from the sin standpoint, it's a big deal. But for who she is, this is a really, think what he's transgressing in terms of loyalty, in terms of who he has, who he loves, who loves him, who serves him. It's a big deal. Okay? And this is a serious sin. Back in the Torah, we've got this in Exodus 20:14, you shall not commit adultery, one of the Ten Commandments, right? And then Leviticus 20:10, if there is a man who commits adultery with another man's wife, one who commits adultery with his friend's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. So this is a crime that is punishable by death. And David is acting on his impulses rather than do that. And we know that David knows the law. Right, he's gone back, and when he's messed that up, he's gone back and studied. Remember, moving the ark, he went back and read the law. He is well acquainted with that. He was a man after God's own heart. And I think, to make a connection to our sermon series, this is James 1:14-15 personified. I remember what James said: but each one is tempted. That's when he looked out the window and saw Bathsheba. And when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust, then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin. That's when he took Bathsheba, right, and took her. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. We'll see that in the next chapter, okay? Because this will not go unpunished. Now, David and Bathsheba will not die as a result of this sin, but there will be death because of this sin. All right, so David sent messengers and took her. Literally, it means he collected her, which puts him in a position of, he's like a purveyor of fine art, he collected her. And Bathsheba came to him. And so what do we have here? Perhaps Bathsheba was naive. Perhaps she's, I've got a message from the king, I have to go. Perhaps she lacked the will to resist the request from the king. Or perhaps her intent was to be unfaithful all along. We don't know, right? We don't know what Bathsheba's motivations are, but David is the one that sends the messengers, and she comes along. And again, the text wants us to focus on the sin of David, not of Bathsheba. Not that she's entirely innocent, but this is to focus on David. And David lay with her. Of course, we know that's an idiomatic expression that means he engaged with her sexually. And as a result, David and Bathsheba conceive a child. And when she becomes aware of this fact, she sends word to the king saying, "Hey, I'm pregnant." Right? Now, notice that those are the only two words that Bathsheba speaks in the whole story. "I'm pregnant." That's all we get. Okay? And again, this is so unlike David. And this is the part that stuck out to me. One commentator said, "The king who is content to be given the kingdom nevertheless seizes with violence the woman of his desire." I mean, he is the epitome of patience as he waits to become king. Right? I mean, remember, all his men are like, "Kill Saul, you've got him, he's vulnerable, just kill him right now." And he says, "I'm not going to do it, I'm not going to touch the Lord's anointed, it's the Lord's will, I'm going to wait for the Lord to do this." He waited 7 years to be king over Judah and Israel. He's been nothing but patient, and here we are in this story. He sees a woman and he just acts. No patience whatsoever, just acts impulsively and spontaneously. That's what I mean. It's so unlike him. It's so unlike the David we've heard about in all these chapters. And I guess the lesson for us there is, as Paul would say, you know, lest you think, you know, you're untouchable here, you might fall too. That's that when you get to that point where, hey, I'm good, I got it, I'm in total control, that's when you're most vulnerable. And that's what I think we're seeing with David. All right, because think about it. David has multiple wives and a harem. Okay, it's not as if David is starved for physical attention. Okay? He can get that anytime he wants to. And so Swindoll again says, "This king who took another man's wife already had a harem full of women. The simple fact is that the passion of sex is not satisfied by a full harem of women. It is increased. Having many women does not reduce a man's libido. It excites it. It stimulates it. One of the lies of our secular society is that if you just satisfy this drive, then it'll be abated." Right? That basically, sin is insatiable. Right? And why does Paul and other writers in the New Testament spend so much time on sexual sin? Because they know that sexual sin is even more insatiable than regular sin is, right? Especially to a man. And so here we have David with all the opportunity, right? Again, he doesn't need another wife. Right? And back then, it's not like, okay, I need another wife to help me around the house. I need another wife to have more children. No, he's got plenty of those, right? Why is he taking Bathsheba? It's because he lusts after. She was very beautiful. Right? It's not like he had a conversation with her and he found out she was a really cool girl and he wants to get to know her better. Right? This was purely a physical idea and from a guy who does not lack in the physicality department. Right? And so that's Swindoll's point, is you would think, yeah, you got a harem of 300 girls over here, you would never go out looking for trouble. And here's David going out and looking for trouble. Right? It's sin is insatiable. So he tries three cover-ups here, and we'll go through that. Now, Vogel says we've got three cover-ups: a clean cover-up, a dirty cover-up, and then a criminal cover-up. Okay, so let's look at those. So verses 6 through 9. "Then David sent to Joab, saying, 'Send me Uriah the Hittite.'" This is the middle of a siege of a major city, by the way. Okay, so Joab sent Uriah to David. "When Uriah came to him, David asked concerning the welfare of Joab and the people and the state of the war. And then David said to Uriah, 'Go down to your house and wash your feet.' And Uriah went out of the king's house, and a present from the king was sent out after him. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house." This does not work out the way David wants it to work out. Okay? And he thinks this is a foolproof plan. Okay? He thinks, "I'll bring Uriah back temporarily, clearly. I'll have him spend a night with his wife. And then in 9 months when the baby is born, everybody will just think it's Uriah's, right? Then I'll send him back to war. Everything's great." And David would have total deniability if anything came up. Because, I mean, I don't know who knows this at this point. The servant that went to get her obviously knows it. So some people know. But he could deny it if it ever came up. Okay? And Uriah, I think, is probably going to David like, "Why am I here?" I mean, he's got messengers. You know, there are guys that are couriers that send messages back from the king to Joab. And he says, I mean, think about it. Remember, Uriah is one of the mighty men. So the word gets to Joab to send Uriah back. Uriah is one of the best fighters that David has. He's in the top 30 anyway. Right? And he says, "Send him back to Jerusalem." So Uriah is probably thinking, "What's going on back at Jerusalem? It must be a big deal to send." I mean, you're pulling one of your best guys out. He runs all the way, you know, probably out of breath as he gets back there. And what is it, my king? And David says, "So how's Joab doing?" You know, and Uriah's going, "You could have asked anybody that. You got messengers coming every other day. Like, why am I here to answer that question? You know, what's going on with the war? You know what's going on with the war. Why am I here?" And he's probably, again, genuinely surprised that he's the one that's been called back. He's probably pretty confused. And then he gets sent out and told, you know, go clean yourself up. And David sends like a bottle of wine and some, you know, chocolate-covered strawberries down there and, you know, nice seat, romantic music. He sends all that down to the house, and Uriah doesn't go down to the house. So, again, David's reference to foot washing was a suggestion that he clean up, stay a while, enjoy a night of intimacy with his wife. And to further encourage Uriah, David sends a gift, probably food and wine, down to Uriah's house. But for some reason, Uriah sleeps at the door of the palace. And I think this speaks volumes about Uriah. And that's the other thing the author's trying to show us here. He's trying to contrast David's sin with Uriah's faithfulness in this story. Put those beside each other. This is a religious decision by Uriah. This is a spiritual decision by Uriah. His name means Yahweh is my light, okay, which probably wasn't his original name if he was a Hittite. Okay, and we'll talk about that in a second. But Uriah was devoted to the Lord, and all sanctioned military activity was a form of service to the Lord, and it required the Lord's blessing for success. That's what Israel's learned. We go to the Lord and ask for blessing. We ask for direction. The Lord directs us in battle. So that's my religious service to the Lord. And so they would view it much like a priest would. Before a priest goes in to offer sacrifices, what does he have to do? He has to purify himself. And so it would make perfect sense, David being the man that he is, would put that same requirement on his soldiers to when we're fighting in war, when we're fighting in holy war, then you abstain. You purify yourselves. Do not make yourselves unclean because then you're not worthy in service to the Lord. So it would make total sense that David and his men would kind of take a vow of abstinence during these times of war, because they believe that they're fighting a holy war and they're in service to the Lord. Does that make sense? So I think that, and that's why Uriah doesn't go down there. And on top of that, this is the idea. If he had sexual relations with Bathsheba, he would have rendered himself temporarily unfit for military service and thus unfit to the service for the Lord. Uriah just wants to get back to the front. You know, I want to get back to my brothers. We're fighting a war here. We've almost won. Let me go back there. And then from a solidarity standpoint, right, all his brothers don't get to come home. So he's like, I'm not going to take advantage of this when all my guys are out there in the field fighting this battle. From a decency standpoint, he doesn't want to do it. From a religious standpoint, he doesn't want to do it. And so it's going to backfire on David. And then don't miss the fact that Uriah is a Hittite. Now, he's not a pagan Hittite, right? That means his lineage is from the Canaanite people. But he's probably proselytized into Judaism. He's a believing Jew. I don't believe that he would be part of this whole inner circle of David if he wasn't. Okay, he believes in Yahweh worship and all that. But the idea that the Hittite, at least the former Hittite, is more holy than the king of Israel is what the author's trying to point out here. Okay, look how sinful David is, when meanwhile even these guys are pure and relying on the law. And this, so it's really, really magnifying David's sin. All right, 10 through 13. Now when they told David, saying, Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, have you not come from a journey? Why do you not go down to your house? And Uriah said to David, the ark in Israel and Judah are staying in temporary shelters, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? By your life and the life of your soul, I will not do this thing. Then David said to Uriah, stay here today also, and tomorrow I will let you go. Because Uriah's probably chomping at the bit to go. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. Now David called him, and he ate and drank before him, and he made him drunk. That's David making Uriah drunk. And in the evening he went out to lie on his bed with the Lord's servants, but he did not go down to his house. So this is the first one was the clean one. This is the dirty attempt at the cover-up, dirty trick, try to make him drunk. This one doesn't work either. So David's starting to panic, and notice what he does when he asks Uriah, have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house? You know, that's kind of guy talk of, what kind of man are you? Like, your beautiful wife is down there in the house. What are you doing? Like, if I was you, I'd be back at the house. That's all I'm saying. I don't know what kind of man you are, but that's kind of what David's doing to him. You know, and Uriah says, listen, you can impugn my manhood all you want, but the fact is, you know, I'm serving the Lord, and the ark's in a tent right now, right? And it's a temporary structure, and all my brothers that are fighting this war are in tents out there in the field. Who would I be to go and spend a night in luxury with my wife? I'm not going to do it. And by your life and by your soul, I'm not going to do it, right? So you can imagine David just, you know, now he's trying to figure out what's going to happen here because he's getting desperate. And then he's going to do the drunk idea. Again, if Uriah's brothers in arms were forced to be separated from their wives, Uriah would not break that solidarity. And so he says, David is stalling now. He's tried to come up with another plan. Stay here one more day. Stay here one more day. I'll let you go tomorrow, I promise. And so he brings him in that night, and he made him drunk. And you say, well, how can he make somebody drunk? Well, when the king says drink this, you drink it. You know, that's basically what it is. You're in the king's house, you're at his table. If he tells you to drink, you're going to drink. And that's what happened. But unfortunately for David, and maybe fortunately for everything else, Uriah does not go back down to his wife. David thinks, well, if he's drunk, all inhibitions will be gone. He'll go down to his wife. He'll back off on his thing. Well, apparently Uriah was faithful with his vow. And he doesn't. He goes back out and sleeps outside the palace again. Okay? And at this point, I would say David is in full-on panic mode because he doesn't know what he's going to do. So here's verse 14, and now you see David get extremely desperate, and you see sin begets sin begets sin begets sin, okay? Verse 14, now in the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah, which is a whole nother cruel kind of thing. Imagine Uriah is carrying his own death warrant in this story. And he had written in the letter saying, place Uriah in the front line of the fiercest battle and withdraw from him so that he may be struck down and die. Okay, kill Uriah. He has now put out a hit on this man. Okay, and Uriah carries his own death warrant. Undoubtedly, the letter that Uriah carried was parchment sealed with the royal signet ring so that its contents would have been unknown to anyone but Joab. That's that signet ring that the king would put a seal on, wax seal on a letter. Nobody can open that except the person that it's addressed to. Right? To open that would be capital crime because it's the king's conveyance of information. That is a bulla they found just below the Temple Mount that has Hezekiah's name on it, that was in Solomon, where the area where Solomon's palace was. Eilat Mazar found that, and that made big news. And so we've got a link to Hezekiah, and that's great when you think about the Muslim narrative that the Jews were never here. Okay, well, we've got a link to Hezekiah. That takes us back pretty far. Right, and then I don't know if you guys saw this just a couple weeks ago. They found this bulla, which is not verified yet, but it has the name Isaiah on there. They think this is the Isaiah seal that the prophet may have used. Now, there's no guarantee it's that Isaiah, but there's a good chance this could be the bulla that Isaiah used to seal his official conveyance in the same area. Okay, so we've got links to Hezekiah and Isaiah there, where Solomon's palace was apparently never there. Okay, so there you go. But just to keep you updated on what's going on in Israel, I think that's if it really is Isaiah's thing, it's monumental. Okay, it's really cool no matter what. But if it's Isaiah the prophet's, that's a huge, huge deal. Okay, because that brings in the idea of canonicity of Isaiah and when it was written and all that kind of stuff. Because everybody likes to try to push Isaiah late. I'm off on a rabbit trail. They try to push Isaiah late because they know how many prophecies impact Christ and Isaiah. Well, you can't push it very late. At very least, you can't push it past the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so, at the very least, those prophecies predicting Christ are 150 years before Christ was ever born. What do you do with those, All right, verse 16. So it was as Joab kept watch on the city that he put Uriah at the place where he knew there were valiant men. The men of the city went out and fought against Joab, and some of the people among David's servants fell, and Uriah the Hittite also died. Notice it wasn't just Uriah that died. Several men lost their lives in that conflict. Then Joab sent and reported to David all the events of the war. He charged the messenger, saying, when you have finished telling all the events of the war to the king, and if it happens that the king's wrath rises and he says to you, why did you go so near to the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who struck down Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal? Did not a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebes? Why did you go so near to the wall? And then you shall also say, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. Make sure he gets that part of the information. Okay. So Joab complies with David's order. We know from 11:1 that Rabbah is besieged. All right? The Israelites have the city under siege. Now, this is why this is such a strange order for Uriah to be sent to the front. Because what's the point of a siege, right? You have surrounded the city, and what do you want to do to the city? You want to starve out the city. It's not, and why do you do that? Because it's a walled city. Because attacking a walled city means you're going to take heavy, heavy losses. But if I can surround your city and take your spring, your water source, and cut off all your gates so you can't get any food in, eventually you're going to have to surrender. Right, and that's what's going on. And they've got it. Rabbah is done. The Ammonites are going to have to surrender. It's just a question of when they're going to surrender. So to send an attack into the heaviest part, which is probably the city gate, which is the most fortified part of the city, this is where they kept all the arms and everything else, to send a group up there is really a stupid move from a military standpoint. You don't attack the gate of a city that you have under siege. You don't have to, right? The city's going to fall. It's just, it's an inevitability, and yet that's what he does. So Joab obediently orders Uriah to attack the city at its strongest point, again, probably near the city gate, and exactly as David hoped, Uriah was killed along with several other of David's men. So several men lose their lives in this battle. Joab sends the news back to David. The news wasn't good on this occasion. I mean, this is a general going back, sending a letter back to his king saying, we've lost a lot of men. So Joab provides that messenger with the instructions, right? Whether this is part, so what's Joab doing here? Is he doing all this to make sure he's not implicated in the cover-up? Because he knows exactly what happened, right? At least in terms of Uriah. So is he making this long detailed letter so that if anybody ever wants to check the letters, they go, oh, well, Joab must not have known about it. Or does he think that the fact that other men died too, that David's going to be mad, and he's trying to explain himself? You know, what's Joab's level of involvement here? That's another thing we don't know. But Joab closes the letter with what David wants to hear, which is that Uriah is dead. And then there's this reference to Abimelech. Do you guys remember Abimelech from the book of Judges? Abimelech is a son of, and he's a horrible person. Remember, he has 70 brothers, and he goes in, and he's kind of he's the son of a harlot from up in Transjordan, and he comes down and kills all 69 of his brothers. Gets a mercenary army, comes down and kills them all, and forcibly kind of takes power there in the time of the judges. And then he goes to Shechem, and he's fighting battles there at Shechem, and he gets cocky when he goes up to one of the fortresses that the people have fled into, and a woman drops a millstone the ramparts there that kills him there, and he's killed by, and remember he says, somebody kill me so I don't die by the hand of a woman. Remember that whole story, is ashamed of it and all that. Well, there's a reason why I think Joab is referencing Abimelech here, because I think he's referencing Abimelech in light of David. And to think that David could ever be compared to Abimelech that's a bad comparison. That's not somebody you want on your list of comparisons. And so David, God's anointed and a great king, is otherwise poles apart from a petty thug like Abimelech. That David is likened to Abimelech has, because of the very distance between them, the effect of diminishing his image. The more so since Abimelech fell at a woman's hands while at the head of an army, and David falls at a woman's hands precisely because he plays truant from war. Okay, David falls at the hand of a woman because he's not fighting. Abimelech fell at the hand of a woman because he was foolishly fighting. Okay, and that's what the author's trying to do. He's trying to connect it to Abimelech. Again, that's a shot at David. Okay, it's a shot at his reputation. Okay, and the other time we get this report that so-and-so is dead is Jezebel sending word to her husband Ahab that Naboth is dead. Remember that whole story, right? When Ahab's in his room crying his eyes out because he can't have the vineyard, and Jezebel says, well, I'm going to take care of this, right? And sends it back and says, Naboth is dead. So these are the two accounts we get of returning things to the king in the same language. And so David has been compared in this one setting here, and eventually, and maybe Naboth is going back because Samuel's written first, but we can connect him to Abimelech and Jezebel. Not a good chapter for David, okay? All right, 22 to 25. So the messenger departed and came and reported to David all that Joab had sent him to tell. The messenger said to David, the men prevailed against us and came out against us in the field, but we pressed them as far as the entrance of the gate. Moreover, the archers shot at your servants from the wall. Of course they did. So some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is also dead. Then David said to the messenger, thus shall you say to Joab, do not let this thing displease you, for the sword devours one as well as another. Make your battle against the city stronger and overthrow it, and so encourage him. And I would argue that this, and I'll say it at the bottom, I think this is David at his very worst. Right? When he hears that Uriah is dead, I mean, you can almost see the smile creep onto his face, and he quotes a proverb. It's almost like he says, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. You go tell Joab he's doing a good job. That's basically what he's done. You know, and that the sword devours in war. Hey, we don't know. People just die in war. It's a fact of life. You just tell Joab to keep fighting and take that city. You know, and so he waxes philosophical at this time instead of, there's no mourning. There's no remorse, right? I mean, he almost goes behind the wall and pumps his fist. All right, good. I'm free of that. Now I'll be okay. All right. Verse 26, now when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. At least she mourns for her husband. David does not. When the time of mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife, and then she bore him a son. But the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. So what do we have in mourning practices in the Old Testament? We're getting ready to see David participate in some of these. You hear about weeping, wailing, rolling in the dust, modifying one's diet, fasting for periods, and then modifying clothing. You would put on sackcloth or you would put on widow's garb. This is what you see with Ruth in the book of Ruth. She's wearing widow's garb. So apparently there was a special garb that they would wear that would identify them as widows. David will put on sackcloth and put ashes on his head, you know, different things like that to show that they're mourning. So here's the other question is, under Old Testament law, what would be the legal parameters for Bathsheba's remarriage? Under Old Testament law, who should be marrying Bathsheba? Brother, right? Now, there must not be a brother, right? And the fact that he's a Hittite probably means that he left his family to come and join David in Israel, and so he doesn't have a next of kin that's a believing Israelite, so there is nobody. And so this is where it really gets kind of sticky with David, and you see about his motivations. So David steps in and marries her. The perception in Jerusalem would be overwhelmingly positive for that. Okay? Understand that. So, because they're going, oh, wow, look at that. The king who loves Uriah so much is going to take up and leave her at marriage. He's going to marry this widow and protect her and give Uriah a son. Right? Like that was the whole point, is the brother was supposed to marry the wife so that the family line could continue. And so here we have a situation where not just anybody's stepping in, the king is stepping in, and he's honorably marrying this woman. So by the end of this chapter, David has not only gotten away with it, but everybody in the city thinks he's a wonderful person because of what he's done. Okay, that's the situation we are here at the end. It's this kinsman redeemer idea. And again, I imagine Uriah doesn't have one, and so he steps in to father this child. And so such a pretext would have made David's actions toward Bathsheba following Uriah's death seem truly noble and would have accounted nicely for the birth of the son, right? Because now, okay, we got this done quickly, and when the son's born, everybody will go, oh, well, you know, that first night they were together, she must have conceived, and now she has a child, and nobody thinks anything of it, right? So on the surface, David has gotten away with it and even comes out of it looking honorable in the eyes of Israel. But as we close out here, the last line is what gets us going towards next week, when the author says, but that thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. So that's going to bridge us into chapter 12, that it looks like everything's coming up roses. You know, Uriah's been killed, Bathsheba's been brought in, she's going to have the son, nobody knows anything all the wiser. You know, maybe Joab, maybe a servant, but everybody's kind of in the dark on it, and David's going to get away with it. And so by law, David deserves death. That he had done evil in the sight of the Lord. It's used in Genesis 38:10 with Onan. If you remember, that's Genesis 38, by the way, means is like the most awkward chapter you'll ever teach in a teenage class. That's when Onan spills his seed, if you remember that awkward story. But when Onan does that, he's killed for it. And it's the same, it's a lever at marriage sort of idea, right? And he's supposed to father the son for his brother who has passed away, and he doesn't do it. He neglects that, and the Lord kills him for it. He says what he did was evil in the sight of the Lord. Same phrase is used here with David, that it was evil in the sight of the Lord. And so David, based on what we see here from Old Testament law and from what we see in Genesis 38, he deserves death. His life should be forfeit because of what he's done. And obviously that's not going to happen, but we are going to see major, major consequences in the next chapter. And of course, he is confronted in the next chapter with the phrase, you are the man, which in our terminology is probably a good thing. It's not such a good thing in his terminology. He's getting the thumbs down. He is the man, but that is, he doesn't want to be the man in this illustration. And that's what we're going to see with Nathan confronting David for his sin in the next chapter. All right, let me back that up so you guys aren't distracted. All right, any comments or questions as we close out that section? Really interesting section of Scripture, like I said. What do you think? Anything? Oh, yeah. mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And there's certainly, and that's a lesson for all of us. A lack of accountability is a dangerous place to be in. Because if you don't know yourself well enough to know that a lack of accountability can get you in trouble, you know, reevaluate who you are, you know, in your sin nature. Yep. Until he's caught, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, we know we can quench the spirit. Maybe that's what's going on, or he's just totally, there. I don't know. There's times when you try to ignore what the Holy Spirit is telling you. There may be something like that going on, but yeah, the credit we'll get in the next chapter is when he does get caught, he responds appropriately. We'll give him that. But why did it have to take getting caught to do that? He should have realized long before that, and something is going on in his heart where, yeah, and now he doesn't have an indwelling Holy Spirit, but the Holy Spirit never left him, so he's in a very similar situation that we are. There should have been much more remorse and all that, and he has distanced himself from God. I mean, in so many different ways, and I think that's where why he's gotten to where he is, that he's quenched that spirit. Yep.
I always wondered why Bathsheba didn't, call a rape or throw herself on the cliff.
Yeah, and there's this is certainly an advantageous position for her as it goes along. Why didn't Bathsheba, call rape or run away or anything like that? And this is King David. I don't know. I wish we had more insight into Bathsheba's thought process. We just don't, So that's why I don't like to insinuate that she was all ulterior motives, Oh, yeah. Yeah, we better understand that. Absolutely. Pastor?
I think David said, in my opinion, about 95% pride, 5% lust.
Yeah.
I don't think that you can put any man in that high. We have that saying about power corrupts.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the deal? And I think that the lust aspect of it was just secondary. Pride seems to un-God God.
Yeah.
And so what's the difference? I'm king. I can have whatever I want. And then we say, but David, how could a man after God's heart commit not only that sin, but such deceit afterwards? But that's the temporary insanity. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Sin makes you stupid. Yeah. That's exactly what. Yeah, that's the easy way. And C.S. Lewis says the same. Pride is the first sin. Everything comes from that idea, right? It always goes back to that. And so we talk, what have we been reading about? Military victory after military victory after military victory. He beats Goliath. Saul kills his thousands. David kills his 10,000s. He's brought back millions and millions of dollars worth of gold and silver and everything else. And we've got people calling him the light of Israel, which God is the light of Israel. Yahweh is the light of Israel. It's a good point. I mean, how he's reading his own headlines, and most of us would probably read our own headlines too. You know, if somebody's telling you that you're the light of Israel, yeah, I'm the light of Israel. Look at all these battles I'm winning every time I go out there. I don't even need to go out and fight my battles. I can send my general out and I can win battles, right? So I think that's exactly what's going on. Let me close this because I think we're about out of time, but we'll continue this discussion next week when we get into chapter 12. Father, thank you for today.